Welcome to the Beacon Broadcast from Beacon Baptist Church in Burlington, North Carolina, featuring expositional Bible teaching by Pastor Greg Barkman. If you'd like to correspond with the Beacon Broadcast, or if you wish to support this radio ministry, write to the Beacon Broadcast, Post Office Box 159, Alamance, North Carolina, 27201, or find us on the web at beaconbaptist.com. BeaconBaptist.com. The Beacon Broadcast is supported in part by the gifts of faithful listeners. Now, with today's message from God's Word, here is Greg Barkman.
Amazing grace.
We have been coming through the final verses of John chapter 3 over the last couple of broadcasts as we have focused primarily on the problem of rivalries among God's people, how the disciples of John took up a rivalry position against the disciples of Jesus and even against the ministry of Christ himself because they thought that it in some way threatened and dishonored the ministry of John, the one that they were following. And so we took a look at the passage with that in mind and tried to figure out why this tendency among the people of God and how we should deal with such tendencies when we see them, and particularly when they are found within our own hearts, as they will be from time to time. But there are other lessons, I think, that can be learned from these last verses of John chapter 3, beginning at verse 22 and following, and we're going to look at some of them on the broadcast today and probably spilling over into the broadcast next week as well, but we'll take it as far as we can today. So that's where we are. That's where we're going. We're grateful that you have joined us on this Sunday, March 24, and we remind you that we do this as we are financially enabled by the gifts of our radio listeners. Now, before we can draw lessons from the passage, we have to know what the passage says, so without apology, I read it. John 3, 22, to the end of the chapter. After these things, Jesus and his disciples came into the land of Judea, and there he remained with them and baptized. Now John also was baptizing in Anon near Salem, because there was much water there, and they came and were baptized. For John had not yet been thrown into prison. Then there arose a dispute between some of John's disciples and the Jews about purification, and they came to John and said to him, Rabbi, he who was with you beyond the Jordan, to whom you have testified, behold, he is baptizing, and all are coming to him. John answered and said, A man can receive nothing unless it has been given to him from heaven. You yourselves bear me witness that I said, I am not the Christ, but I have been sent before him. He who has the bride is the bridegroom, but the friend of the bridegroom, who stands and hears him, rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is fulfilled. He must increase, but I must decrease. He who comes from above is above all. He who is of the earth is earthly and speaks of the earth. He who comes from heaven is above all. And what he has seen and heard, that he testifies, and no one receives his testimony. He who has received his testimony has certified that God is true, for he whom God has sent speaks the words of God. For God does not give the Spirit by measure. The Father loves the Son, and has given all things into his hand. He who believes in the Son has everlasting life. And he who does not believe the Son shall not see life, but the wrath of God abides on him." Well, before we look into some of the additional lessons, we might even call them miscellaneous lessons from this passage, let me focus upon the primary purpose of the passage, which is basically to record for us John's last public testimony concerning Jesus the Christ. And if you were listening to my words, you heard a strong, clear, powerful, convincing, convicting, encouraging testimony of John the Baptist concerning Jesus Christ, who he is, and why he came. But there are other lessons. We've already dwelt on one, the unwholesome rivalries among God's people, but there are many others, and we're going to look at several of them. So I begin with the need for training. And where do I get that? "And after these things, Jesus and his disciples came into the land of Judea, and there he remained with them and baptized." What was Christ doing? Most commentators tell us that this period lasted from 6 to 8 months. The disciples of Jesus, presumably at least the six referred to in chapter 1, that is, Peter, Andrew, James, John, Philip, and Nathaniel, were with him, and others no doubt as well, because that word disciple is not restricted to apostle. So undoubtedly, there were a group of people who were following Jesus at this time. And again, what is Jesus doing with them? Well, he is training them by teaching them, and he is training them by example, and he is training them by drawing them into participation with his ministry, because training, maybe I should put it this way, ministry requires preparation. Ministry needs training. Don't shun it. You say, well, you're squeezing an awful lot of juice out of that one text. Yes, I am, admittedly, deliberately, purposefully, but unapologetically, because that's exactly what's going on here. After these things, and that follows the encounter of Jesus with Nicodemus, after these things, that follows the miracle of Jesus turning the water into wine in John chapter 2, and the cleansing of the temple, also in John chapter 2. After these things, after Christ's call upon a number of the disciples, the ones several of whom would become apostles, in John chapter 1, after these things, what happens? We find Jesus takes his disciples away from Jerusalem, away from Galilee, away from population centers, away from the crowds, out into the wilderness, because, of course, that's where John is from. So if he's near John, he's out in the wilderness, and indeed the place that is described here fits that description, out into a place where there are not huge crowds of people normally, not where they live, not where they conduct their daily business, but where many of them came to him, but that made it a more manageable situation. The only ones who came were the ones who had some interest. I'm not saying that they were necessarily born again, but they had some spiritual interest. That's why they came. And so Jesus is able to utilize this situation in a rural area to train his disciples over a period of 6 to 8 months. And again, how did he train them? Number one, by teaching. How do we know that? Simply by reading the four Gospels and seeing how Christ dealt with his disciples and what a large part of what he did with them was teaching. That wasn't all that he did, but everything that he did was built upon the foundation of teaching. So training begins with teaching. How else did Jesus train his disciples? Well, he trained them by example. He brought them aside to where he was over a period of time, where they were in close proximity to him. They were involved in his daily activities, and they had the opportunity to observe him, to see how he lived, to see how he interacted with people on a daily basis. It's one thing to see how people react, how leaders, let's put it this way, react to people in a formal setting. We see how they react to people when they're preaching to them from the platform in church and when they're involved with them in some kind of public ministry. But so many Christian leaders, particularly the most famous ones, tend to isolate themselves from any opportunity for people to observe them closely in private. Just think about that. Some of the men who have fallen into the worst scandals, it's very apparent that that's exactly what happened. They only allowed people to see them in public settings. They only allowed people to observe them in, what shall we say, artificial settings. That may be the wrong word, because, of course, public ministry is an important matter, and it's not really an artificial setting as such. But in a sense, it is controlled, it is designed, it is constructed in such a way that it is constructed for the greatest effect, the greatest impact, for this leader to be able to have the greatest influence upon others. He's got a whole team of people, a whole staff of people who are very much involved in this setting in order to make him look good, to make him effective, and to make him look good. In this day of public relations, and in this day of electronic communication, television, and so forth, there's more of that than there was in Christ's day, but there certainly was a measure of that in Christ's day as well. And great leaders, I call them great, maybe I should say leaders who command a significant following, have a reasonable expectation of a certain amount of privacy when the public ministry is over and they're drained. And believe me, I understand that. I do understand that. You probably don't understand that very much unless you are in public ministry or have been. But if you are or have been at some time in the past, you understand what I'm talking about. There's something about preaching and teaching that drains one. At least it does me, and I think it does most men, a great deal. On the one hand, there's a tremendous satisfaction in doing it. Doing what you're called to do, doing what you're gifted in doing what you have prepared to do, and doing it and seeing the impact it has on others, seeing them receive the word, seeing them impacted by it and changed by it. You have this time of public ministry. You have this time of interaction with people after the public ministry, as people come to you many times and relate to you in what ways that particular message impacted their lives. And then when that's all over, there's a you're just tired, you're worn out. And again, a lot of people can't understand that because they haven't done that. It's hard to understand, which you have no experience with. But I remember a preacher, a very gifted, very powerful preacher that I respected and I spent quite a bit of time with in years gone by. We're talking about way back in the early years of my ministry, who told me that a doctor told him that one time of preaching, I think he called it 1 hour of preaching, but of course most people don't preach an hour, but one preaching service, let's put it that way, in a public church service generally does last more than an hour altogether, and though the preaching doesn't generally occupy an hour, it can, but though the preaching doesn't generally occupy an hour, that's all wrapped up in a package, and the preacher is very much involved in all of that. And he told me that that doctor said to him that 1 hour of public ministry takes the same toll upon the body as 8 hours of physical labor. I've thought about that a lot. I really have no way to confirm or to challenge that statement. There have been times when I have said, no way, it can't take that much out of you. I have worked in construction. I have worked in a factory. I know how much energy, how much strength can be taken out of a person in working an 8-hour shift in one of those situations. It can take a great deal out of you, and that's back when I was a much younger man than I am now. It can take a great deal out of you. It can leave you very much physically tired. And yet, I do know that there have been times when 1 hour or a little more, an hour and a half of a public church service drained me pretty much as working 8 hours in a factory did back when I was a younger man. How is that possible? I don't know. I can't explain it. And I'm sure it's not going to be exactly the same with every person. Some preachers are more active and more physical in their style of delivery than others are. But I just said that in order to give you an idea that this kind of activity, this kind of work, this kind of ministry can be very draining, and it's not unreasonable for a preacher to say, I need to get away. I need to get away from people. I need some rest. I need some privacy. I need to be able to just spend some time with my wife and family and to recover my strength. I need to be out of sight. But the danger is to use that as a rationale for shutting people out of your everyday normal life at all times. It's one thing to say, I need periods of rest and recuperation, as we all do, and as Jesus did. And he withdrew into isolated places deliberately for the purpose of recovering his strength, his energies. He did that. He told his disciples, it's time to draw away and to rest a while. So this is legitimate. But so many of the things that become problems are legitimate things that are taken beyond the boundary of what is actually legitimate. And what I'm suggesting to you is that part of the training of the disciples of Jesus was to be invited into his life on a daily basis and to be able to observe him, not just when he was preaching to the crowds, but when he was going about the daily routines of life, to observe him then. And so, training is, first of all, by teaching. That's the foundation. But training is, secondly, by example, over time, giving people an opportunity to observe you in close activity. If a Christian leader is not a godly man in private, then he's not really a godly man in public. He only seems to be. Again, we see so many of these stars, these superstar preachers and Christian leaders who fall, and fall tragically. I'm thinking of another one right now that happened within the last 3 or 4 months. A man with a mega church ministry, multiple location type ministry, who's written many books and had a tremendous, tremendous ministry. And he had to step down and take a furlough, and he basically was required to do that. He was requested to do that by the leaders in his church because of things that had happened. And without getting into all the details, because I'm not particularly interested in identifying this person publicly and saying negative things about him, because I think his teaching has been pretty sound. But it does seem to me that one of the problems was that he isolated himself from people and only allowed his public ministry to be seen, and he had this certain persona in public, and that his behavior in private was not the same as his behavior in public. He seemed to be a man who was very arrogant and had a hot temper and abused people verbally in smaller settings, close staff members and so forth, and board members, and he was a different person in private and in small settings than he was on the stage in public settings, and that led to his downfall. Now, again, we have to be careful here. There are no perfect people except Jesus. Jesus was the perfect man, and he had no downside. He had no ungodly side. In private, he was always as godly as he was in public, and that's the ideal. That's what we should all aspire to, and none of us do it perfectly. We all have times when we let our hair down, to use a phrase, when we allow ourselves to be a little less holy, I guess you would say. We're not guarding ourselves as much as we would in public settings. But here's the thing. If a man's wife and children cannot honestly say of him, "My husband, our father, is the same person at home that he is at church. He's the same person in private that he is in public. We see his same commitment to Christ and his same zeal for righteousness and godliness and humility and love. And we see that in his personal life as much as in his public life. If that's not true, then there's a real, real problem." I'm thinking of another Christian leader that I've gotten to know over the years. I used to hold him in awe from a distance when I was a young man, because he was just so bigger than life and so powerful in his public presence. Another man in a similar situation comes to mind as I'm speaking, but I'll continue thinking about the first one as I describe this. And then over a series of circumstances that I won't be able to give details about now, but over the years, it became my privilege to get to know this man in a very personal and private way. I had him in my home. I joined him, I started to say joined him on vacation, not exactly joined him, but almost, I said almost by coincidence, but there was a little bit of design in it. My wife and I ended up with he and his wife in the same vacation location on an occasion, because it had been arranged that way with communication with his daughter, though we were in different facilities, actually not even in the same exact facility. We were in resorts next door to each other in a particular place. We were there, and we got together for meals, and we spent some time together. And in various ways, over the years, I got to know him in his private life in a way that most people didn't, and I really hadn't planned for that or lobbied for that. It just came about that way as I got to know him over the years and found him to be every bit as impressive and godly as a private individual, as a husband, as a father, as a friend, as he was in public. In fact, I think I would have to say, if anything, he was even more impressive in his private life than in his public life. And I knew that he was real. I knew that he was genuine. I knew that I was dealing with a true, godly man. His public life was not simply a persona. It was not just a result of outstanding gifts that he had been given that he was able to use in public. It was an outgrowth of his character and of his godliness. And that's what Jesus was doing with his disciples, was showing him that side of him, showing them how a Christian lives in private as much as teaching them how to minister in public. I'm thinking of another man who was even greater in his public ministry than the one that I just described a moment ago. And yet, again, though he has had influence upon multiplied millions of people, millions, through his preaching and his media outreach and the books that he has written, God allowed me on several occasions to get to at least converse with him personally, something that most people don't have the opportunity to do, and I was able to do that on several occasions, and I was amazed at how kind and gracious and humble he was in private conversation. You wouldn't get that idea from his public ministry, which was so strong and, if I can use the word, powerful and dogmatic. And you would almost expect he would be a difficult person to talk to personally, but it was just the opposite. He was one of the most humble and gracious men in private that I've ever known in my life. And that's the man that people who were close to him knew. They not only knew the way he conducted ministry in public and how his gifts were utilized for the kingdom of Christ, but they also knew how that his relationship with Jesus Christ impacted the way he dealt with other people and how he demonstrated genuine love and humility and did not demonstrate arrogance and did not demonstrate overbearing authority and did not lose his temper and did not shout at people and bully people as some leaders do. But he did not. And the people who were closest to him were the ones who were the quickest to testify, this man is everything in private that you see in public. In fact, there are sides of him that are even more gracious, more manifestations of the presence of Christ in his life in private than you get to see in public. And that's part of the training of Christ's disciples. He taught them by teaching, but he taught them by example, by inviting them into his life personally, and then he trained them by participation, by allowing them to be involved in the ministry. We read elsewhere that Jesus did not baptize, but his disciples did. He was teaching them how to teach others. He was teaching them how to relate to interested people, to inquirers. He was teaching them how to conduct ministry. He was teaching them how to baptize. He was teaching them by involving them in these activities. And why? Because they needed to be trained if they were going to be effective. Dear friend, are you interested in ministry? Then don't neglect the training. Don't be one of these people who's so proud you think you don't need that. Yes, you do. May God help you. Until next week, Greg Barkman saying good day. May God give you his eternal peace.